Glad to have you. I was hoping we'd have more people. You know, the last class is always, sometimes they say the first impression is the lasting impression. I say the last class is maybe more of an impression, but in any event, does anybody know what's special about today's date? And I didn't plan it that way, but it worked out, so I can enlighten you with it. Is anybody looking up the date now? Today's the 7th of Adar. What does that ring a bell? I'm glad you don't know, because this way I feel I'm teaching you something you didn't know. This is Moshe Rabbeinu's Yahrzeit. Oh. 7th of Adar is Moshe Rabbeinu's Yahrzeit. What's even more fascinating, it is also his birthday. So you say, so what's so great about that? One in 365 chance, although the solar, our year is a little different, could be as few as 354 days and as many as 370 or whatever, when you have the leap year. So you say, so what's, I mean, other than saying the chances are one in 300 and something that would happen, the fact that it's Moshe Rabbeinu's Yahrzeit and his birth date, we are taught in the Gemara, we're taught in the Talmud that it is very auspicious. It's a very, very good sign to be born and to die on the same date. Something you probably never heard, but it is definitely one of the teachings. So now you ask, and by the way, another auspicious thing, it's a little bit different. It seems to be a siman tov if you die on Shabbos, but that's a different situation. I'd be curious, I don't have a calendar that goes back that far, but I'd be curious if he died, and if Adar the 7th was a Shabbos when he was born and died. But nevertheless, to be born and to die on the same date tends to intimate that the person led and completed his life, led a full, complete, righteous, in this case, of course, with Moshe Rabbeinu, life, and therefore it is a good sign. So that's what today is, the 7th of Adar. I'm going to tell you something else that I can tell you without exception, including myself, without exception. When I point something out to you now, without exception, I never, if people were honest, obviously, anyone that I told this to, and I told it to many, many rabbis, Orthodox, conservative, many cantors, and amongst you, I may have already told some of you that, so if you know it, you know it, but nobody that I told was aware of it. I shouldn't say it, that were aware of it. They never realized it. And when I told them, it was like, oh my God, I never realized it. Okay, now what am I leading up to? Moshe is Mem Shin Hey. What is it in reverse?
Hashem.
Okay. Did anybody ever figure that out on their own? I doubt it. Did anybody ever know it from before that I tell? So this is all like new to all of you, right?
Yes.
Okay. This is one of the reasons I hate conference calls, because I feel like sometimes I'm talking to myself. And the only, I've gotten feedback from Neil and occasionally, you know, a couple of people, but it's very, very tough teaching like this. However, I mean, if I were in a class, I'd call on somebody or something. And if you disagree with something I say, I told you, please tell me. But Hashem is the backward of Moshe. Now, I don't know about you, but when I learned this, of course I had never realized it either, but when I learned this, I was in awe of it. Because if you stop and think of it, it borders on mystical. Obviously, we believe Moshe was the closest to Hashem. And so there's some kind of a mystical aspect to it. Secondly, it's very interesting. There's an Orthodox rabbi who has a blog on here, and I believe he's from Australia or something like that. And he wrote, for last week, he wrote, one of the things he wrote was how it says that Moses spoke face to face to God, and he quoted peh el peh, and I corrected him. I said, it's not face to face. Peh means mouth. It doesn't mean face. Pani means face. And I pointed out to him that another pasuk, as you know, said that no man will see my face and live. God may have seen his back, and then the Talmud goes into the fact of what did he see? He saw the tefillin knot in the back of his head, that God wears tefillin. Actually, there's a midrash that says God wears tefillin, and so what is contained in it? These are my people, and whatever. But peh el peh doesn't mean face-to-face. It means mouth-to-mouth. So Moses was really the only one that spoke to God mouth-to-mouth. Obviously, it's all metaphor anyway. Now I come to the final thing about today, the 7th of Adar. Nobody knows purposely where Moses is buried. And I think I touched upon this perhaps last week or the week before or whatever. Does anybody remember why?
So we wouldn't make him into an idol.
Exactly. He wouldn't be treated. He wouldn't be treated like Jesus. Let's say he wouldn't be treated like. I hate to use the analogy, but like the Lubavitch are treating Menachem Schneerson. It's practically borders on Christianity the way they're. I think you are all aware of what I'm talking about. He's treated they believe he is Mashiach, and that's totally contrary to Jewish teaching, totally. First of all, he's dead, and Mashiach is not going to be dead. And the whole thing, and my point is they know where his grave is, they go to his grave, and they practically make an idol out of him. But Moshe Rabbeinu, that is the reason why, Neil, exactly what you said, that we wouldn't treat him, we wouldn't deify him, so to speak. But that basically, I just wanted to hit upon. I would be remiss if I didn't talk about it because today is obviously the yahrzeit of Moshe Rabbeinu. Any comments before I go on to the next topic? No.
No. Go ahead, Naomi.
Yeah. Who was the female voice? Rebecca?
It's Naomi, and I was thinking, and I retract the question before I ask it. I'm done. Go ahead, Neil.
Okay.
Well, this is a friendly crowd in which to spout a slight amount of thoughts, which is
apikorsum.
We don't know. I was trying to figure out how to make it into from Greek into Hebrew. We don't know for sure that there actually was a real Moses. According to archaeologists.
So that's a total, Neil, that would be a history course. That's not a theology course. Because you understand what I'm saying? I don't want to even get into that because that's not my field to begin with. I mean, there's people that say that there was no Jesus either. So I don't really want to get into that. Was there really and it's a good question. But obviously, we don't have an answer. But I didn't mean to cut you off. Were you going anywhere with that?
That's fine. Go.
I mean, it's fine. And believe me, it doesn't bother me that you said that because I'm constantly troubled, conflicted by our whole theology, and by in general the theology of. There's a big difference whether the Torah was given by God through Moses or whether man wrote it. And if man wrote the Torah and they said and it said inspired by God, that's a world of difference. Because a lot of people say, "Well, I was inspired by God and so on." I've had this conversation with many non-Jewish clergy. It's very interesting. Because they will tell you, especially Catholic priests, and even a good friend of mine who's a Protestant clergy, that they were chosen, that God chose for them this profession, and God chose them to go to whatever congregation they're in, and they legitimately believe this, that God chose for them whatever they're doing. You'd be hard pressed to find a rabbi to say, God chose me to go to a congregation, Agudas Achim, or whatever. God chose me to go there, as opposed to he had a placement and they went to the placement. I mean, a lot of my non-Jewish clergy can't believe that individual congregations are autonomous. They're self-autonomous, and that we don't have a pope, or we don't have someone that's saying we can go here, we go there, and so on and so on and so on. So I say all of that because the theology is totally different. And so in regard to what you said, Neil, it's just part of the whole let's say theological difficulty that we encounter. So go ahead, I'm sorry.
It's Naomi, and I didn't want to ask my question before without a text in front of me, but now I have my text, so I'm going to ask. When you talked about what that Orthodox rabbi wrote on his blog and that you wrote back to him, and you said something about te el te, I'm not sure where that comes from. I know there's a contradiction in the text, because actually in the verse 10 at the very end of the Torah, it says, V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael k'moshe, asher yad o Adonai panim el panim. But back in Exodus chapter 33, God says, V'haya ba'avor kvodi v'samtich v'nikrat hatsur v'sakoti chapi alecha ad avri, ovri, v'hasiroti et kapi v'ra'ita et achorai upanai lo yera'u.
I'll
take my hand away, you only see my back, my face must not be seen. But then why do they
say
panim el panim at the end?
I can give you, there's a homiletic explanation for that, and it has to do with the fact that it is at the very end. But the point is, you should see where, it's funny, he just sent me an email because I had sent it to him before. You should see where it says Peh El Peh. Let me read to you what I wrote to him. And this is his response to me. He said, you wrote, yet the Torah says, I speak with Moses face to face. If you want to see the source, look at Bamidbar 12:8, chapter 12, verse 8. I said to him, I humbly disagree with your translation. Pe el pe means mouth to mouth. It does not mean panim el panim, face to face. And I said to him, further proof of this is in Shmot chapter 33, verse 23. Which clearly states what I just said. Now, here's what he writes to me. This is his response, and this is a rabbi knows a lot more than I do. He says, you are certainly correct regarding the translation of the words peh el peh, but I am focusing on the meaning, particularly the conflict between the suggested intimacy alluded to in peh el peh and the coolness implied when God's voice coming to Moshe from behind the mechitza, from behind the barrier. He hasn't proven his point at all. If anything, he's proven my point. I'm just reading his answer now. Does everybody agree with what I just said his answer says? He's saying that God's voice is coming behind the mechitza, from behind the barrier. If it's behind the barrier, then how can it be mouth face to face?
I think he's referring to when Moses is stuck into the crack in the rock.
Whatever, but it's not face to face. And in answer to your question, Naomi, the face to face at the end. Just tell me one second. Give me the verse
Devarim
is it?
Chapter 34, verse 10.
Okay, hold on 1 second.
The very end.
I have a good memory, but not that good. 34, verse 10. 31. Okay.
34 verse 10.
And I was studying this. I guess I was eating something because there's food stains on it. Very first time. All right. Glad I got some response. God, thank God. I know somebody's there. 34. Now, again, as risen from Hashem had known face to... Okay. This now it's easy. Very easy to answer. God, Hashem knew face... Hashem can do what he wants. Moses didn't know Hashem face to face. Hashem knew Moses face to face. You got the subtlety.
Very nice.
That's the difference. Naomi, you with me?
I'm totally with you. I'm looking at the word yida'o. I'm totally with you.
Okay, so that's the answer. That's why I knew there was a reason.
Otherwise, it would be asher yada. But this is
right.
Asher yida'o. God
right.
knew him.
Very good. So
I will sleep much better tonight.
Oh, I hope so, especially without the pills. All right. Now we go. Because I sometimes have to take a melatonin. You ever take melatonin? No one knows it. You know what melatonin is?
Yes, I've taken it only when I've flown big distances. It's supposed to help you regulate. But onwards.
Exactly. Right. Okay. So let's go. By the way, as long as I said that, there's a whole shaila about taking medicine which is not kosher. I'm glad I mentioned that because it's funny. Subconsciously, I probably did that because I wanted to discuss that. It's something that's very interesting. So you would think, well, what's the big deal? If it's medicine, you take medicine. If it's not kosher, there happens to be poskim who rule that you can't take medicine that's not kosher. Most are makel on it. Most will say, well, they make a distinction between, a capsule, a pill, as opposed to liquid. So they're saying if it's a pill, it's all right because you're not having it as food per se. Whereas if it's a liquid, it's like taking a beverage. It's like taking a beverage or something to that effect. So. When it comes to that, there are, as you see, it's they actually have vegetable coatings of medicine today, vegetarian, so that it's not like gelatin and that type of thing. And therefore, the other question is asked, what if you have to have a shot, a vaccination, and it has, let's say it has Pfizer in it or whatever, is there a problem with that? And the answer is absolutely not. Because the halacha is against ingesting it orally, not through a shot. In other words, there's no. In fact, if somebody had, this is very interesting. If somebody had, God forbid, a feeding tube in their stomach, they can be given treif in the feeding tube. They can be given whatever they want, whatever they want. It's not going to make too much difference to them. But whatever is put in there. It could be all treif, and it is not breaking any halacha for the most observant Jew, because the isur, the prohibition is against ingesting it orally through your mouth. Same thing, if you wanted to have a pigskin belt, there's no halacha against that. You can have a woman wants to have a pigskin, an alligator pocketbook.
All the Jewish baseball players are okay. That's what you're saying. Because they have pigskin gloves.
Oh, absolutely. However, now if you'd had asked it, I would never think of this. There's actually a shaila. Let's say you take a shower, with a towel. That's shotness, the towel shotness. If you put the towel around you, you know, like you, to be decent, you put the towel around you if you're in, let's say, at a gym or whatever, that's considered, you're not allowed to because you're wearing it. you're wearing it because it's shotness. Now, you might ask, if a glove was shotness, a baseball glove, would that be prohibited? I don't know. I don't think that would be considered a garment. But on the other hand, you could say you're wearing it. But as far as a pigskin, absolutely no prohibition. The prohibition with shotness is against wearing it, not eating it. That's the difference.
So
So
I'm
that would apply also to a
go ahead.
This is Sherry Allen.
Hi.
It would, that would apply to, like, if you're going to have like a heart valve replaced and they use, like, from an unkosher animal as well?
If you had a what? I'm sorry?
Like a, you know, like a, some kind of a transplant or any kind of organs or valves or anything that...
Very, very interesting. Absolutely wouldn't matter. You could have a pig pancreas, whatever. No, there's no prohibition against anything like that. But since you hit upon it, again, I'm glad you asked these questions because I wouldn't have thought of saying this. There's a very, very big controversy over heart transplants. I'm talking from a human. There are people, as you know, that are on a list waiting for a heart transplant. And the way secular law, civil law is, if somebody is brain dead, legitimately brain dead, then the heart can be removed from them. Remember, a heart transplant, it has to be a live heart. Once somebody dies, it's too late. I mean, once let's say there's a cessation of all of the respiration and so on. So in Judaism, most poskim would rule that you can't have a heart transplant. The interesting thing is the Talmud talks about, the analogy is, let's say somebody falls out of a 100-story building and they fall, and obviously when they hit the ground, they're going to be dead. And it talks about if you had a gun or a bow and arrow, and in those days it didn't talk about a gun, but if you killed that person a tenth of a second before they hit the ground, you would be guilty of murder. In Judaism, that would be the same as killing. So consequently, the same thing with a heart transplant. You can't take somebody's heart before they die. Not allowed. Now, I think there are poskim who rule that when you're definitely brain dead, they would consider that as if you're dead. I don't know. That would be something you'd have to research.
Okay,
I'm sorry?
I have researched this, and I actually know quite a bit about this at this point because it was part of my last chaplaincy unit training. And there is an entire group of Orthodox, very big name rabbis who have actually supported organ transplantation
on the
basis of
what I just said.
The electrical signals. Basically, here's the kula that they found, that the cessation of electrical signals to the portion of the brainstem that regulates breathing is considered now, in their eyes, to be the equivalent of the old thing of a person, you know, stop all the machinery and, you know, put your ear or a piece of tissue or something to see if the person is actually breathing on their own. They've basically accepted the technology, which says that we know exactly what itty bitty piece of the brainstem controls the regulation of breathing, and once the electrical signals to and from that part of the brainstem are flatlined, that at that point, these very big name Orthodox rabbis are willing to accept that that's the definition of death.
That's excellent, Neil. As you know, I said I really was under the impression of what you just said. I was under the impression there are post-team who do allow it now, and you confirmed it, and I appreciate that, and that's definitely the case. Now I'll tell you something that, by the way, somebody just came in, I guess, but now I'll tell you a case. I learned this maybe half a year ago or so, and I don't know if you're aware of this, and I was flabbergasted, and I asked different Orthodox rabbis, and it's almost as if they were like, oh yeah, that's allowed. But wait till I tell you what it is. Now, you know the way the conventional halacha is, you don't have to attach somebody to life support. You don't have to. If somebody, you know, you could. But once you do, you cannot disconnect it except in a case that Neil just explained and when they see that. But But here's the chiddush that I was so fascinated by, and nobody else that I talked to seemed that fascinated by it. I mean, some did, but if in this Moshe Feinstein supports, if let's say you want to attach somebody to a life support, if you attach them to a life support with a timer, in other words, you attach them to life support and you time it for 12 hours, that's perfectly all right, as long as it stops on its own after 12 hours. Now, that to me was revolutionary, because the way it used to be is you cannot disconnect that. But they were talking about an active disconnection, not a passive disconnection, so that if you set a life support to somebody and you set it for 12 hours, 24 hours, whatever, then once that time comes, it stops on its own, and then you can decide what you want to do then. You could, you know, put it back on for another 12 hours. I just found that fascinating. Were you aware of that, Neil?
Yes, and it also happens to be part of state law in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Right. Well, that I didn't know. But I anybody else, I mean, did anybody else feel the, well, if you're aware of the traditional halacha, then you should definitely have been fascinated by it. Anybody else have any comments on it?
Well, I guess.
Okay, I'm going to go now to, we're coming
Dude,
up
think,
to Purim.
I was trying to say something. Linda Sue did have a comment.
No, that's okay. Go ahead. Just move on.
I didn't hear you, Linda. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. No, I guess my question is, how immediate does the act have to be in order to be considered active versus passive? So I guess my question is about, you know, setting a timer versus doing the act yourself. And
you cannot act yourself. It's against Jewish law. You
right.
cannot
I,
disconnect the machine
I,
on
I
your under, own.
I understand that, you know, that you're
okay.
setting up a machine to make that decision, you know, to make the decision to cut off the life support. And I guess...
Well, it's not... Yeah, it's not that the machine is making the decision. You've programmed it, but you're
right.
not turning it off.
That's
okay.
right. But so that in itself is an act. You know, and
no,
so
it's a passive. That's considered passive. It's the same thing as a Shabbos.
I know, and I have
clock.
Issue with that, and I have issue with that as well. You know, to me, you know, what is it that is the active part? Is it you're setting the timer, or is it that the timer then is going because you set it, and now the timer is going on its own? So now it's a machine. You know, a machine that's acting on its own. And
okay, you're,
you know,
what,
and
you're
it,
having.
It,
what you're discussing is a philosophical difference,
exactly.
and I might agree with you philosophically, but for halachic parameters, there is a big difference
yes.
between you actively going and pulling the plug,
yep.
as opposed to putting it on with a timer. You could be away and you could be in another state, you could be sleeping, whatever. That timer on its own is going to go off. You can't accelerate it. You can't once you time it for 24 hours, you can't put it to 12 hours. Mm-hmm. You let it go. You follow me? That's
I
still
totally
passive.
Understand, but I think you're right. I think the thing that I'm concerned about is the philosophy behind the
absolutely, and I can agree
right.
with that. You know, it's the same thing with active euthanasia and passive euthanasia.
Right. Yeah.
Kevorkian was an active euthanasia, yep. Euthanasist, whatever the word would be for he did active euthanasia. Passive euthanasia would be the following. I have, let's say, God forbid, cancer, and I do nothing. I don't go for chemo. I don't do anything. That's passive euthanasia, in a sense. That is not considered contrary to Jewish law. On the other hand, you can argue that you're supposed to do anything for, you know, to prolong life. But in a case of a terminal illness, there are many poskim that do not say you have to make yourself miserable longer. And so that would be passive euthanasia as opposed to act. Active euthanasia would be I take a bottle of sleeping pills. I mean, that's killing yourself.
Right.
So that's not allowed.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you bringing it up because it is a philosophical thing, and we can argue on it, and you know, and still never come to a where you'll agree with me or I'll agree with you, or you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely. Okay, great. Thank you.
Can I ask you one question about this? It's Sherry again. Because I think maybe I missed something. So the timer thing, is the timer set when the patient is already on life support, or is that done?
No. That's a very good question. In fact, that's a Talmudic type of question. The answer is, if you put a patient, I'm really impressed with your question because I never would have even thought of that question, because I know the answer, I assume, but it's an excellent question. The question is, if you put life support on a person and you don't time anything, then it's too late. Mm-hmm. See, l'chatchila, in other words, in the beginning, if you have in mind, you put the thing with a timer and you time it 24 hours, 22 days, whatever you want. Okay, however it works. Okay, and that's allowed. As I say, that to me was really revolutionary. But if you take a person and put them on life support and don't do anything with a timer, too late then. You can't do the timing after that. That was your question, I assume.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense to me. I mean, that makes sense to me. But I guess then the issue is, I mean, it's really important to decide and for the person to have, an advanced directive or whatever, or to have this conversation before that even comes up, because, it just makes it so much easier if the person does not want life support in the first place. But if there's no, clarity about that, and the real choice then becomes, do I put them on life support with the 24-hour timer thing, or do I not at all? Because once I do, it's too late. I mean, that's a really difficult choice to make. So I guess the bottom line is make sure you have that directive in hand.
You're right, except, and I may be wrong or misstating this, but I don't think the conservative movement is concerned with – I think the conservative movement allows – pulling the plug if it's really to the point where it's obvious a person is going to die.
Right, and,
okay.
And
I think
this is Linda Sue again. I'm very much into technology. I'm very, very fairly savvy about gadgets and electronics and machines and things. And thing that I would fear most is that the timer would break and somehow get stuck in an on position and not go off. And then what?
Technically, you couldn't do anything.
Right. And yeah.
What if, here's a perfect example. You set a Shabbos clock. This is for, let's say, really observant people that are not going to put a light on. And you set the Shabbos clock for the light to go off at 10 o'clock Friday night because you want to be able to sleep,
mm-hmm.
for the lights to go off in your house,
right.
And the thing gets stuck.
Right.
You can't turn the lights off.
Right.
So that's the same thing. But when you say you're concerned about it, I mean, technology, there's a lot of kinks in technology. Just look at your cell phone.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of kinks in technology, but it's a concern, obviously. But then again, if you put a DNR on somebody, I'll give you an example. The way civil law is, and Neil is aware of this as gone into chaplaincy, the way civil law is, if a person has a DNR, let's say I have this happen. I was at a place and the person in front of me had a massive coronary and dropped dead right there. But the person was still... there was still some breathing, they call it agonal breathing, whatever. And somebody dialed 911, and the EMTs came, and the wife of this man was yelling, "No, no, he has a DNR." And you know what they said? "Lady, once you call us, the DNR is invalid. Once you call us, we have to do what we have to do, unless you could produce the DNR right there." And that was it. It didn't work anyway. He died. But the point is that if you have a do not resuscitate a thing, that's acceptable in Judaism. But if you do attempt to if you do attempt to resuscitate them, and then you can't undo that. So anyway, the technology issue is an important, very important factor. I promised you last week that I would touch upon Purim, and I'm going to bring certain things in that are interesting. Some of you may never have heard some of these things, and I, as you know, one of the things I like to do when I teach is to try to bring things that you haven't heard of. Or obviously some of these things you have, but okay. Obviously you all know beginning Rosh Chodesh Adar, there's a custom actually to hang a sign in the home that says Mishenichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha. You all know the famous Mishenichnas. Anyway, so they hang the sign. When Adar comes in, one increases his happiness. Some have, this is interesting, some have the custom to place this sign to cover the Zecher L'Churban. Does anybody know what the Zecher L'Churban is in a house? And this is something you may not have known.
In, it's kind of like the equivalent of a Mizrach, that it's supposed to, it's like with the Slobobish households who do think Schneerson's the Messiah. They've got pictures of them all over the place. So I've been in a couple of homes where there's like a picture of the Kotel or a picture of the Temple Mount itself, and that phrase above it, Zecher L'Churban, just to remind you.
But halachically, the Zecher L'Churban is not the picture. The people have the picture. It's an unfinished wall area. This is actually, this is what they have in traditional, real Orthodox homes. They will, when they build a house, they will have an unfinished wall area that many have that custom. It's not a halacha, it's really more of a minhag, to retain in their home. And if you want to look it up, it's in a Yalkut Avraham, 686, Piskei Teshuvot, 686, 5. It's in 686.5, and it's an unfinished wall area. But what you mentioned, Neil, is the same principle. That's why they have it. So, but my point is for Purim, they will cover the Zecher L'Churban because they don't even want to be reminded of anything sad. So you might find that interesting. One reason for the minhag to get dressed up in costume on Purim, you ready for this? Is to allow the poor to collect money on Purim without embarrassment. So in other words, everyone gets dressed up, and since everyone is in costume, the poor do not stand out, and they can disguise themselves. Interesting. Now, what secular holiday does this remind you of?
Halloween.
Absolutely. Very good. Halloween, with Lahabdil, as we say. I mean, Halloween is a pagan type of holiday. But the interesting thing is that on Purim, everyone dresses that way. Now I'm going to give you a corollary, which some of you may or may not know. Prior to Yochanan ben Zakkai, I believe it was Yochanan ben Zakkai in the Talmud, when people died, when Jews died, they would dress them up. Like you see when you go to a non-Jewish funeral, someone's in a suit and a tie and this and that and so on. And this is, Jews would do the same thing. They dress in different garments and so on. Comes along Yochanan and Zakkai and legislates what we have today, Tachrichin. Everyone dresses in they're dressed in the white shroud. Why? Does anybody know why?
The idea is that we should all be equal in death. You know, we take nothing with us.
Right. And there was let me give you the sociological reason. You're absolutely right. The sociological reason is that the rich would show off by expensive garments and this and that and so on. So it was so as not to embarrass, it shows our sensitivity, so as not to embarrass those who couldn't afford the garments that they were wearing. So therefore, they all had to be, dressed humbly, so to speak, and that was what they did. Now, as you know, a male is dressed in with a tachrichin and also has a tallit. Okay, you're all aware of that? A man wears a tallit.
But you have to cut off one quarter.
Yep, exactly what I was going to say. Why? In other words, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to, go ahead, not important.
No, I was going to say, Neil knew what I was going to say, that you cut off one of the fringes. Now the question is why. You were going to answer this now.
No.
I'm
not going to answer.
What were you going to say?
Isn't it because you're not using it for the ritual purpose that it was intended for, that it's not, you know...
That's a roundabout answer, but that is the answer. The basically answer is because they even give another answer. They say it's almost like mocking. It would be mocking the deceased by giving them a kosher talis, like saying, "Ha ha, you can't perform the mitzvahs now." So by cutting it off, it's not mocking him, but it's basically what you said. I mean. But the element of the in fact they even say the shomrim should never discuss anything that has to do with mitzvot when they're watching the body because it's like mocking him. He can't do it, and there's a belief that the deceased is aware of everything until he's underground. I don't know if you've ever heard that before. To me, it's rather scary. I hope it's not true, but anyway.
I just have a question about the tzitzit. I'm actually sitting here with a book on the Jewish Hospice Manual because Jewish Hospice is coming to my community, and I'm going to be involved in that. But it says the fringes are cut off. Is it only one corner, or is it all of them? And then my second question.
I'll explain to you. That's a very good question. They're putting fringes, but that's real. Here's what the essence is. It has to be made what's called pusel. Pusel is non-kosher.
Right.
You don't call it shreif because shreif has to do with food, but pusel. And the way you make it pusel, if you cut off one knot, that's all you have to do. But the custom is you cut off the fringes more than all you have to do is make it pusel. And by making a pusel, you have to have, on a talus, you have to have 5 knots and 8 strings, okay, on 4 corners. If any one of those corners is torn, is like the knot is gone or something else, it's pusel. So that's all you have to do. Whether you want to do 1, 2, or 3, it's irrelevant. Do you follow me?
Yes. What do you do
now,
with those fringes after you've cut them off? Do you have to bury them like you would bury, a scroll?
That's a very good question. The answer is absolutely not. It's like a yarmulke. I've seen you've probably seen people that are, let's say, not that well-versed in Judaism, drop their yarmulke and they pick it up and kiss the yarmulke. Mm-hmm. That's like if you drop your handkerchief. You're not going to kiss your handkerchief. I mean, there's nothing inherently holy in a talit that is pusel. But the only thing you would bury is if it had God's name on it. You know, on a lot of talisim it has the bruch up there, and then it becomes holy. But the fringes itself, you could throw in the basket. It doesn't matter. There's not, perhaps not. Perhaps it would be a little disrespectful to do that, but you certainly don't have to bury them.
Okay.
In answer to your question.
I have another question on that.
I'm sorry?
I know a female rabbi who's asked that she be buried with her tallit, and I know it's typically only men traditionally that are buried with a tallit. What is your thought on that?
Well, that's a loaded question. The answer is, it's very simple. If I were Orthodox, I would say it's ridiculous, but we're not Orthodox. So since we're egalitarian, if we allow women to wear talisim, whatever, if we allow them to wear it, if you're allowed to wear it and you're allowed to put tefillin on and you want to be buried in your talit, I would see it's certainly not against conservative law. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to the fringes, I got the feeling that Neil was going to disagree with what I said.
No. What I was simply going to clarify, I actually did a tahara recently, and I'll say something in a minute about what it turns out those garments were, but I, just apropos of the one fringe that we cut off, I took it and added it to the collection of stuff for the next time we do a Geniza burial. Just a quick comment about the garments of the Tahrikim. It turns out that there's a one-to-one correspondence between what we're reading right these weeks in the end of Exodus. These are basically the underwear that were under the beautiful robes of the Kohen Gadol that we're reading about in the Torah now. And I'm very good friends with a Ukrainian Catholic priest, and he showed me his fancy robes. They are a one-to-one correspondence with the outer garments.
Oh, yeah. High priest. Oh, yeah, there's a great correlation. Getting back to what you're saying, Neil, a talit itself has to be, as a Geniza would have to be buried. I'm saying the fringes that
I
you
know,
cut
I,
off.
I just chose to do it. Yeah, I know I didn't have.
Yeah, you could do it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. But you certainly don't have to. That was my point. I just want to let you know. Unfortunately, I have to go promptly at 5, so we have like another 10, 11 minutes, and I hate to do that, but you know, that's just the class is an hour long. So I brought this up last week, and I don't know if some of you weren't here last week. I asked you, what is disturbing about the following halacha in regard to Adar? And I said, if one has a court matter pending with a non-Jew, and this is right from the Talmud, if one has a court matter pending with a non-Jew, one should make an effort to have the matter heard by the court during Adar, because in Adar, the mazal, the constellation is Dagim, which is fish, and the evil eye is not effective. So, I find something, let's say, disturbing about it. What would you find disturbing about it? I mean, it's pretty obvious to me. I don't know. Anybody?
I'm sorry,
again,
it's Naomi, and someone sounds like they're maybe driving or in a place with running water or something. If that's going on, can you mute yourself? It stopped.
Say this again?
There.
Oh, not yet.
There's a lot of interference. It sounds like maybe someone is near running water or driving, and I was just wondering if they could mute themselves.
Oh, yeah. If there's any, thank you for telling me. I hate distractions. I haven't heard anything. Does anybody hear anything?
I did, too.
Yeah, no, I'm hearing it, too. Yeah.
You're hearing it still?
No.
Seems to have quieted, though.
Okay. Well, whatever it was, it's gone. Getting back to Adar. If one has a court matter with a non-Jew, one should make an effort to have the matter heard during Adar. What's disturbing about that?
Well, superstition and astrology for two things.
No, forget the astrology. Forget the fish. I shouldn't have even said that. What's this? Forget that. But what is the trouble? What's bothersome about saying that that's actually, if somebody has a court matter pending with a non-Jew, one should make an effort to hear it during Adar?
Well, it's implying there's a difference, but, you know, court you'd like to think of as being an honest judgment between two people that are fighting about something, but it implies that it would be different with a non-Jew than with a Jew.
Well, of course, and in essence, it's like it's taking away, to me, a court matter should be decided on the merits. Not if one is a Jew or a non-Jew, and not if you you know you're going to have extra luck during Adar. I just but there's a lot of, that's not unusual, by the way, that type of thinking. Anybody else on that? Now I'm going to ask you what is strange about the following halacha? It says here. It's from the Mishnah Brura. It's from the Shulchan Aruch, 689, verse 6. It says, children who are too small or young to understand that they cannot disturb the adults during the reading of the Megillah should not be brought to shul. What would? Okay, I'm glad you got it. I just thought that was rather strange. If anything, it's a kids' holiday, and it seems contrary to what we do. So.
It seems contrary to what we do, but one of the commandments for Purim is to be able to hear the Megillah, to read the Megillah, the Megillah. And can you do that if you're being distracted by your kid?
I mean, you're absolutely right.
What we do, but it's so important that every word of the Megillah be heard, which is why traditionally as a reader you're supposed to repeat Haman's name even after everyone's booed, if you feel that people, were booing so much that you didn't hear the name.
And you're absolutely right. And therein lies the conflict. And I was hoping that someone would say what you said there. Therein lies the conflict. And the conflict is, for pragmatically, or let's say halakhically, you have to hear every single word. And if you miss one word, you're not Yotzei having heard the Megillah. And you have to hear it. You can't hear it on a loudspeaker. By the way, that's against halacha. And I'm sure we all have, and I know I have a microphone. I always would use a microphone in a big place. That is against halacha. You will not find any Orthodox synagogue that uses a microphone for the Megillah. So then you say, well, how can they all hear it? But that's the whole point. They constantly set up these roadblocks. And it's just very impractical. You're supposed to hear every single word, and yet you have kids and everybody making all noise and so on. And to me, it's next to impossible to do. So all of a sudden, you can't bring small children because they're going to be disturbing you. The whole place is disturbed.
Yes. Isn't this kind of the same sort of situation that, I can't imagine that this is also a conservative ruling, because it's the same kind of thing as like, you're allowed to drive on Shabbat because it's better to synagogue, because it's better to be in synagogue than to not go at all. Wouldn't this be the same thing, in terms of taking your kids? I mean,
absolutely. In terms of conservative, in the conservative movement, they're not going to say that if you miss a word or two words that you're going to be you're not Yotzei the Megillah. You're right, in the conservative movement, but in the Orthodox movement, if you were to ask an Orthodox rabbi, is it better that I stay home and not come to shul on Shabbos, or at least to drive? And you know what they answer? I don't want to know. I mean, I can't give you permission to ride on Shabbos. But deep down, they know that their members are riding on Shabbos. So, yeah, it's very similar to that. In other words, there's the realistic, and then there's the practical realistic, as opposed to me, which sometimes they put up these roadblocks. But you're right. I think there's a correlation there. Next thing, women and children are not obligated at all in the mitzvah to become intoxicated on Purim to the point of being unable to differentiate between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. So what it's saying is you ladies don't have to get drunk on Purim. Aren't you happy?
Yeah, because they have to drive the men home.
Yeah, I was going to be funny and say, not if it's on Shabbos. Obviously, Purim is not on Shabbos.
Right.
But the point is I always found that troublesome, and so have a lot of other people, because there have been crimes committed in Jerusalem because of teenage boys and maybe girls that got so intoxicated that they were committing crimes, and they were using the rationale: it's Purim, we can drink, we can go, we can get so smashed that we don't even know the difference between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. So that's another. Halacha that is just not, to me, it's not a healthy halacha. On the other hand, some people think it's wonderful. And I had a rabbi once that Simchas Torah and Purim, he'd bring a whole bottle and have it on the pulpit, and that was the green light to get drunk. So anyway, that I just wanted to know that women and children are not obligated, and in this country, and our law, civil law, children are not allowed to drink, let alone get drunk. Just a couple of more, and then we're almost. Inasmuch as the reading of Parshat Zachor is from the Torah, according to Halacha, we do not permit a bar mitzvah boy to read this portion of the Torah. So that's just it's from an Oda B'Yehuda. It's one of somebody's rulings there. And then it says, generally, we would insist on someone of at least 18 years of age to read Pasha Zachor. Remember, once you're bar mitzvah, you're an adult in halacha, and yet when it comes to reading Pasha Zachor, which is diorita from the Torah, they insist on someone at least 18 years of age. Why do you think that's so, when halachically it could be somebody 13? Anybody? Now, of course, Parshas Zachor is important. Does anybody have any ideas?
I guess because the women and children were behind and Amalek attacked them, and a young person might be so impressionable that they would get concerned. So they need, or
yeah,
maybe is 18 the age of being able to serve in the army? And
well, no, that had
able
nothing
to defend
with
oneself?
The army at that point. No, I'll tell you what the age is. This is interesting. There is an age where, and I learned this long ago, and there was an age where you are where you would be chayiv misa from malchut, where you would be. Oh, there is a certain age where you would be judged, and then you'd be, let's say, your penalty would be Gehenim. That's a whole different issue. But that age isn't until 20. In other words, up until 20, it's treated differently. So the age would be 20, not 18. I don't know why they picked 18. Oh, yes, I do. Now I do. In fact, it just came to me. They give the age of 18 as the desirable age for a man to get married, whether you know it or not. 18 is the age they get for marriage, and that's probably why they picked it. That's probably why they picked 18. So, because if you're at that point, if you're able to get married and so on, then therefore, you know, you could, you would be, they would consider you capable of understanding Parsha Zachor, of having a full understanding of it. But it's, you know, it's a suggestion. It's not really a it's not a halacha, but it's a strong, strong type of a suggestion. Anyway, our time has come to the finish here, and I want to thank you all for your attentiveness. We have a few more people that came in later. I have no idea who's here. Benny, are you here? I guess not.
For all of us, Richie? Can I say thank you on behalf of all of us? May I say to you thank you on behalf of all of us who've been with you for all the sessions?
And
Gamatem, I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure. It's been difficult because of the format of it, but that's not your fault. How do you find, Becca, are you still there? Yeah, how do you find the other, I'm not the first person that's done classes on conference calls. How do you find the other classes on conference calls?
Well, this is really all that we do in terms of the Nash and Drash. And
Nash and Drash is a little different, isn't it? I mean, it's not like, it's more of
a. They have all different formats. Some of them are more discussion, some of them are presentation. I mean, it's limited, but given that we're spread all over the country, for now it's what we have and what we've been using.
I'm happy we have it. I mean, it's better than not having anything, but I just find that it's sometimes difficult because you don't, you know, you're not getting the feedback that you might get if you were in a regular classroom situation, which is, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
Let me just say this. This is a commercial I'm giving you. I was asked to be part of a session at the campus convention, and I'll be participating. It's either a Tuesday or Wednesday. Offhand, I forgot.
Well, I can tell you exactly when it is because I'm the one that's facilitating that.
That's right.
That track.
Sherry, you talked me into it. Tell them what it's going to be.
Wednesday. Well, your particular session is Wednesday, May 22nd at 9 a.m.
Okay. Well, I hope that some of you are able to make it, and I look forward to seeing you there. And, Becca, I can't thank Rebecca Carmi enough. I mean, Rebecca and I go way back, and you don't know how lucky we are to have Rebecca. That's all I can say.
Well,
so,
we're very, very lucky to have you. I want to ask people if they could just email me feedback on the course. This just helps me, you know, when I turn now to shape whatever the next course will be. We really, you know, we want these courses to serve you. So the more information you give me, the better we are at creating those courses. So if you could just, you know, give me, like, what are your takeaways? What did you like about the class? What did you learn? What did it increase your feeling of connection to the organization? What could be better? And I know that the telephone format is difficult. We have begun experimenting with WebEx. That also has challenges, too. So I just would appreciate hearing from you. You know, anything you'd like to tell me. We do have our EC meetings, our executive committee meetings, executive council meetings this week in New York. So it'd be nice also to be able to share some of the feedback to let the greater membership know what we've been up to here in our little Sunday afternoon.
Rebecca, I'm going to go. I thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Okay.
And thanks all of you for participating.
Okay.
Happy Moshe's birthday.
Yes, happy birthday, Moshe.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Okay, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.